Hi there. Thank you for downloading to listen to Iconocast. This is a science and advocacy podcast. This is episode 31. So if you listen to episode 30, that was Greg's interview with Megan Bond. And at the end of that, there was a piece that Greg and I did about the Reserve Mining Company in the North Shore of Minnesota. We kept on talking about Northern Minnesota, and we ended up talking about a lot of different things related to that, including the floods in Fargo, Moorhead, and Grand Forks in 1997. And we decided that we wanted to share that conversation because it was actually a lot of fun. So tune in, hang on, and listen.
I just had a long conversation with Megan Bond. If things go as we expect, listeners to this podcast have heard that conversation already. Now we're moving on to the next topic. And when I talked to Megan, we talked a lot about mining in northern Minnesota. And although we made reference to the earlier iron mining and its importance in the development of the environmental movement, we mainly focused on copper nickel sulfide mining, which isn't being done now, but it's being threat to be done in northern Minnesota. And we talked a lot about that. But you have been researching the Reserve Mining Company incidents. Right. Why don't you tell us what's that about?
Well, I'll just give you a little bit of background because you referenced the iron mines. But originally, there were three main iron ranges in northeastern Minnesota. There was the Vermilion Range, the Cuyuna Range, and the Mesabi Range. And they started mining iron in Minnesota in the 1870s and built a lot of the skyscrapers in a lot of the steel for the United States came from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and in the Iron Range in Minnesota. By the 1950s, though, iron was running out in the Iron Range. High quality iron ore that came out of the Vermilion Range had been taken. In the Mesabi Range, there was still quite a bit of iron, but it was tied up in a type of ore called taconite, which is a low-grade iron ore. It's not as easy to extract. And so the process for extracting iron from taconite, since it's about 30-35% iron and the rest is rock, is to crush it up in really fine dust and take these huge magnets. And then the magnets would take the dust that was iron, and then they would have to do something to dispose of the taconite. These are called tailings because that was pretty much what was left over. It was like the tail end of the process. And in the 1950s, the Reserve Mining Company was a joint venture of three different large iron mine companies. And so what they had decided to do with the tailings was basically to take them down, and they built this new town called Silver Bay, which is just north of Duluth, probably about 30 miles. And they built this really long chute. And if you drive along the North Shore Drive, when you get to Silver Bay, you'll see this big long chute coming from a hill at the top of town over towards Lake Superior. And from this is where they would take and they would run all the tailings. They would just shoot it straight down into the lake. And in the 1950s, everybody thought this was great because it was a way to preserve jobs in the Mesabi Range so that the miners that had lost their positions at the Vermilion Range and at the Cuyuna Range, they could move and they could start mining and feed their families. Because this was the main industry in northeastern Minnesota. I mean, there was fishing and camping and hiking and stuff like that, but this is kind of what paid the bills, paid the taxes and all that. So it was really a vital industry. And so it seemed like a good deal for everybody. But then in the early 1960s, there had been like a really great herring fishery in Lake Superior because there were small fish. They would also feed other fish like lake trout and some of the other things that we would fish, as in the resorts, and also commercial fisheries would take the larger fish. But they were starting to see that the hauls were getting smaller and smaller and started investigating. And scientists were taking a look down into the area around Silver Bay to see if they could determine what happened. And then the bottom of the lake, they were seeing coatings of materials from the tailings that were preventing the herring from hatching. And so it was killing the herring fishery. And so they started taking their concerns, and it was a classic environmentalist versus the town type of situation where the environmentalists kind of considered wackos that were trying to tell them how to run their lives, and they needed to have their jobs and all that stuff. And so the environmentalists that were raising concern and the fishermen that were raising concerns about what the environmental effects of the tailings were not getting very far until they brought in some people to do water testing to see if there was anything in the water. And they discovered that there was a form of asbestos that was in the water. And so it must have been an element that was is the rock and this part of the rock in the taconite. The thing about it is that back then, Duluth and Superior, which are two large cities right at the very western corner or peak of Lake Superior, for the water supply for the city, drinking water, and what they would take in for laundry and all that kind of stuff, that was coming directly from the lake. It wasn't processed. They didn't have like a water cleaning system like we do in our modern municipal water systems. And so if you open up the tap, the water that had been taken up into the tower and that was dropped down into the line to give you water pressure, it was just coming through the lake. And so they discovered that there was asbestos in the water. This was also at the time that we knew that there was asbestos cause different types of cancer. The researchers took their results and they went to the EPA. And EPA in 1973, I think it was in 1973, the EPA was formed by the Nixon administration.
I think so.
So they took the results to the EPA, and the EPA went to the Reserve Mining Company and said, well, you're going to give cancer to everybody in Duluth and Superior if you don't find a way to dispose of the tailings a different way. And the Reserve Mining Company said, well, there is no one. We looked at all kinds of alternatives and there's nothing available. So we have to do this, otherwise people are going to lose their jobs and we won't be able to build any more skyscrapers. And so then the EPA took them to court in 1973. And there was a year-long trial. There was a judgment, and the judge was Judge Miles Lord. And I remember a lot of this stuff from reading the newspapers when I was a kid. It was like in the Daily Star Tribune. There was always an article about Reserve Mining Company. So by the end of the year, Judge Miles Lord handed out a ruling that said that the Reserve Mining Company had to stop dropping their tailings into Lake Superior. And of course, the Reserve Mining Company filed a countersuit, and then they appealed it. And the process took about 7 years. There was an alternative site that had been discovered by geologists that would work satisfactorily at a place called Milepost 7. And the EPA proposed this site to Reserve Mining Company. At first, Reserve Mining Company said, no, that won't work. And it's not too far away from Silver Bay. And I'm not sure which road it's on, but it's called Milepost 7. And basically just a pond that they can dump it in. And in 1980, it was finally ruled that this was a satisfactory solution. And both the Reserve Mining Company and the EPA agreed that they could, instead of dropping the tailings into Lake Superior, they put them in at Milepost 7. And that's basically how that turned out.
It sounded like it was an important milestone in environmental regulation.
It was actually the first time that a government agency or a federal government agency that actually sued on behalf of the environment and actually made a case and won. So it was pretty significant. And when you proposed talking to Megan about the new mines that are being proposed up there, that's what brought it to mind.
Yeah.
So it sets a pretty good precedent.
One thing I want to just say something that isn't that directly related to your point you're making, but we are an international podcast. We have, I think, one listener in Australia at least. but when I moved to Minnesota, I heard the word range being used a lot. So right. I assumed there was a range of mountains somewhere. I figured they weren't very big because I'd never heard of mountains here. Oh. But so I remember driving up north. One of the very first time, days, weeks I was here, the very first thing I did was to drive up to Itasca for a conference. And I took the long way back. I drove from Itasca to some point to Grand Rapids east.
Oh, that
east.
Is a long way around. Yeah.
I drove way east over to near Duluth and came down that way. Okay. And so, I drove north a few times and I thought one day I'm going to go up and see what the range is. And we are actually, my daughter and I were going to go to Ely, and I knew Ely was north of the range, but right. Our destination was Ely, which is, for those who don't know, for those who are listening to Megan, Ely is in the middle of the area that includes the Boundary Waters and is kind of between the Boundary Waters and the Voyageurs National Park area.
It's a lodge point. Yeah. It's kind of a lodge point for people that want to portage.
Yeah. If you're going into Boundary Waters, you go to Ely and you go to the outfitters, and that's where you find your guide. So, and I got up there and I remembered, wait, I thought we were going to go over the Iron Ranges, but I didn't see any mountains. So of course I got out. It turns out we have this major concentration of information someone has done, which all the information in the world has been put in one easy to access place called the internet. So I went there and I found out that the word range is not like it's used. It's like Minnesota, a ramp is a parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
Only in Minnesota is a ramp a park. Everywhere else, a ramp is a little side road that goes on and off of a highway.
Yeah.
Okay. In Minnesota, a ramp, we park in the ramp next to the building. Okay. And a range is an underground rock formation peaking up somewhere, outcropping, but not as a mountain. It's just, that's where you, that's, and they are just, as you point, you name them all, they're distinct places where iron ore is found, and they're completely flat. The only thing that sticks up anywhere near a range is the pile of tailings that has been made from mining. Anyway,
the highest point in Minnesota is 3,400 feet. It's Eagle Point, and it's somewhere up in, in the Arrowhead Range.
If you drive from, I don't remember where you take off. If you take off from Lake, you go up Lake Superior, up on the North Shore, and take a left, I think it's Route 1, goes into Ely. That's not how most people get to Ely. Most people go up through the woods. If you go to the lake and head into Ely, you are at the lake, which is the lowest point in Minnesota. Lake Superior Shore is the lowest point in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Lower than where the Mississippi exits the state in the south. And then you drive straight up to that Eagle Point. It's not far. It's a really short drive. And it's up. It's almost like you're in a mountainous area somewhere. Your car will start to like overheat a little bit if you have one of those kind of cars.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's right there. Yeah. And this, of course, is the edge, like the edge. It's a beautiful place. The North Shore is the edge of an ancient rift valley. So as you drive along the North Shore, it was that Route 51 along the lake.
61
along the lake. So to your right is usually a big cliff going down to the lake. So and if you can drive down a few points, but you're up above the lake pretty far. But to your left is an even bigger cliff going up to the inland. So you're driving like on this rift wall. And every so often, at a pretty regular interval, there'll be a river. And at each river, there's a place to stop, and there's a little, you know, smoke a bear hat guy or a ranger station kind of thing, a parking lot, and you can walk up these rivers and down the rivers and see the waterfalls. And it's something you wouldn't expect Minnesota to have. But Minnesota has, how many waterfalls on the North Shore are there? I mean, we don't count them. We count like an entire river's worth as one thing.
Yeah, there's. I took a trip up there on a motorcycle this last summer.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I stopped at quite a few of them. Like Gooseberry Falls, I hadn't seen since I was a kid, you know, and then there's Cannon and Kettle and all, you know, a whole bunch of them.
And Gooseberry is one that everyone goes to.
Yeah.
And then as you go up, and we actually did it last summer too, we went up all the way up to Pigeon River, which is on the Canadian border that comes out of Grand Portage.
Yeah.
So
you saw the South Sawtooth Mountains then, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Those are not mountains. I mean, they look like a saw with the teeth on there. And I don't even know if they were an ancient range, but they were just ridges, right?
Yeah.
And because everything was kind of smoothed out by like three or four glaciations.
And it's 23 glaciations.
Yeah.
23 glaciations probably. 23. Maybe, wow. Yeah. Or maybe it's only 18, but there has been 23 glaciations in total in North America. And I don't know if they all hit Minnesota, but I bet most of them did.
Well, and we know the Laurentian Shield did, that's for sure.
Yeah, the last few definitely did.
Yeah.
And there are places there where the sedimentary rock is flat, like it was laid down.
Yeah.
And it was laid down 700 million years ago, 800 Precambrian or earlier. And there's one place near, it's, what is that town up there, Grand Marais?
Yeah, that's the next one before Grand Portage.
Yeah, so Grand Marais has that, the part of the Sawtooth, that ridge goes all the way up to Grand Marais. I don't think it's called Sawtooth up there, but it's this sedimentary rock. They've been amorphic now, mm-hmm. and it works in such a way that it has been fractured so that if you like poke at it with a sledgehammer, you're going to get blocks that are 3.5 inches long, 3/4 inch tall, and 1.5 inches thick. Like it breaks into these standard sizes, and that stuff falls down a slope, and it's really hard rock. It's iterated with chert. I think it's also iron ore, frankly, low grade. And it goes into the lake where it then rolls and rolls and rolls for a couple hundred. Well, the current is like a couple thousand years anyway. So you get these amazing pebble beaches in a few places where every pebble is the same exact size, because these rocks break into the same exact size blocks and they roll down and they turn into this. Then there's also the Lake Superior agates. And I don't know much about the agates.
It's a beautiful gem, and I'm not really sure what minerals make it up. But
well, I think it's going to be all silica with impurities in the silica. So it's going to be aluminum and all kinds of other impurities in it. Yeah.
Over the years they've been smoothed out and tumbled.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. Speaking of the cliffs. I learned a few years ago, like 10,000, it's only 10,000 years ago that the last glacier melted. It's really recent.
Yeah.
And as it melted, the continental shelf had been squeezed by the weight of the glacier, because it was at least 1.5 miles thick.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's up to 4 miles, maybe that's over where I grew up in the Red River Valley, but it was really very thick. And so it was heavy enough where it was pushing the continent down, but as it melted, the continent
rebounded,
compressed.
Yeah.
And so that raised up the land where the ice had been. And then of course, as the water ran into Lake Superior, then it compresses the rock underneath the water there. So mm-hmm. combination of the one going down and the other one going up led to the cliffs along the western part of the northern shore.
Mm-hmm.
So like when you get up to Grand Marais, that's not, the cliffs aren't quite as pronounced, but
And I wonder, I wouldn't be surprised. And of course it is already a cliff there, because it's the edge of this valley, the mid-continental rift. But that's an ancient thing. So lots of things have happened since then. And that rebound would do that. And I wonder if the glacial flexing, which happened several times in a big way, 4 or 5 times anyway, if that contributed to the fracturing of the rocks in this particular way, where they're all very uniformly fractured, because it's basically deforming it. But yeah, it's underappreciated how much. But then if you go along the shore and you find these rivers, if it's 1800, 1805, and you're a European, what you do is you're there because you're in the fur trade, right? The fur trade is going full blast here, and many of these locations, the you mentioned, but the Kettle River, major inroad into the interior there, the Pigeon River, which I mentioned up on the Canadian border, that's a major inroad to the interior. Mm-hmm. And we don't know much about what's going on in there. What we know is that there were these outposts that recorded things, and they recorded, how many furs they got and what they paid and all their provisions and all that stuff and who was working there. But then those people would go inland with Native Americans, and they'd meet up mainly with Native Americans who were bringing the fur from a large catchment area where they were catching the fur. works. So you go up that cliff you mentioned, and you go inland a ways, and now all the water, if you're right near the river, is flowing into the river and back into Lake Superior. But all the other water is flowing the other way. And that's the water that goes all the way to Hudson's Bay.
Right.
Right. And that's the water that goes through Voyageurs Park, goes up over, you know, so this whole, if you were listening to Megan's discussion with Megan earlier, that's the water that was flowing into, in the ancient days of the last glaciation, into Lake Agassiz. And today it flows up north. The Red River flows north. This water flows north all up into Hudson's Bay.
I think you know why the Red River flows north, right? But I wonder if our listeners understand.
Why don't you tell them?
So when speaking of Lake Agassiz, Lake Agassiz was this giant inland freshwater sea or lake. And outflow from the lake was flowing south. It flew south down through what is now the Red River Valley, and then it went down and it cut over into what is now the Minnesota River.
Right.
And then it flowed down into the Mississippi, and then from the Mississippi down to the sea or the Gulf of Mexico. But there was so much sediment that was being carried from the outflow of Lake Agassiz that when it reached down to what is now like Bois de Sioux, which is like that kind of weird hump on the left side of Minnesota, that it was starting to build up. It would build up higher and higher to the point where it could never actually, the flow was interrupted from the Warren River. So it stopped flowing as far as the Minnesota, and it kind of backed up.
Right.
So it started backing up, and then it started flowing north into now what is Lake Winnipeg.
So, right, which is the low spot, the wet spot left behind by
right
Lake Agassiz. I just want to tell you one story of a friend of mine who lived in the area of Fargo-Moorhead years ago. And she had a run-in with Blockbuster Video in Fargo. Mm. It might have been in Moorhead, where the floods were, because there was on both sides of the river, right? They had basically ruined her credit. Like that, she couldn't get a credit card because she had not returned a video or whatever. It was a bad situation.
She couldn't. So, she came over the bridge, I'm sure, right?
Right. Well, she got the video. She found it. She got it, and she went to. She was going to go into town to return it, but that's when the flood happened that you mentioned earlier, the 1990s. So she wasn't able to go to town.
Yeah.
And so she waited till the flood was over, and she was, you know, like she was going to go back a week later and return the video to the Blockbuster. But you recall, ironically, we saw this with Hurricane Isaac just the other day, where you look at the film of what was going on in that disaster, and there were buildings on fire. So yeah. Why does something catch on fire in a hurricane? Well, because of various reasons, but often electrical systems are disrupted or things are physically damaged. Like if you took your house and crunched it up, you'd end up with wires crossing potentially, or you end up with gas lights. People are lighting gas and whatever. For various reasons, we end up with fires during floods. And there was this famous newsreel that many people have seen of the Fargo flooding, where there was a city underwater and buildings sticking up out of it. And three or four, the main block downtown was burning to a crisp.
That was Grand Forks, yeah.
Was it? Okay.
That was Grand Forks, yep.
That's where her Blockbuster Video was.
Yeah.
Her Blockbuster Video store burned to the ground. Now, okay, I told the story wrong. Sorry. I now remember the details of the story. I might have edit this. She had actually stopped as the flood waters were rising, she stopped at the Blockbuster Video in Grand Forks where she owed the video. And put it in the nighttime return box and got out of town. And yeah. That's the building that burned down with her video in it. And then she wasn't able to prove that. And that's why her credit got messed up by Blockbuster.
Well,
that's what happened.
Yeah. That downtown that's where we did all our Christmas shopping and stuff like that. When I was a kid, name all the department stores and stuff like that. And
yeah.
Lunch counters and all of them are gone. And I went up to Grand Forks probably about 5 years after that. And it just didn't look the same. It was completely different looking town because they rebuilt it.
Better?
All the old buildings were, yeah. Well, I mean, in a manner of speaking, it looked more like more like a suburban strip mall area, I guess.
Yeah, it's not as nice as with the old buildings. Right?
So I wanted to go back to the mines real quick and tell you something that's important for science. One of the ranges, the Vermilion Range, that ran out of high-quality iron ore, was a Vermilion Range, and there was a mine there called the Sudan Mine. And that was actually the first mine in the Vermilion Range.
I was hoping you're going to. I was hoping you're going to tell us about the Sudan Mine.
Yeah. So they realized that if they're going to collect and try to discover these particles, these so what type of particle is it?
It's neutrinos.
Neutrinos. Yeah. And neutrinos, they wanted to collect and see if they could prove that neutrinos exist because they're theoretical particles. And because they're so fast and they're so tiny, they can go through like miles and miles of solid material without getting, without interrupting or getting interrupted by the molecules that are in the rock. And so there's a collection site in the Sudan mine, and they're hoping to capture neutrinos. And so there is a science good end of the story to the Vermilion Range, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, I actually was invited several years ago to give the keynote address at a conference on the Sudan mines.
Oh yeah.
Which is kind of like I was asked to give a keynote address at a conference on food safety. I know nothing about food safety. I know nothing about the Sudan mines and neutrinos. But the reason was they wanted an archaeologist, in the case of Sudan, it was at the University of Minnesota, to tell them, particle physicists, what archaeologists would like them to do for us.
Oh.
Because particle physics can be used to do things like date stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't know what they're doing there now, but the interesting thing about the Sudan mine, it's an underground mine.
Yep.
And I know a guy who worked there. I see him at a case, he's a member of our Development Environmental Caucus. We see him at meetings. Very interesting guy. He lives up in Tower, which is a town that right near Sudan, which is where the
coldest spot in Minnesota sometimes.
Yeah, can be.
Low.
And the mine's cold too down there.
Yeah.
But you can go there now. You can actually physically go down the mine as a tourist. You can go down and visit the mine. And the iron in that mine has, you know, iron ore has oxygen linked to iron.
Right.
And the configuration of iron and atoms and oxygen atoms in that stuff has one extra oxygen, which means that when you're burning it, you're basically burning rock to get ore into steel, into iron. You're burning it and the iron melts out. Well, having that extra oxygen molecule in there, oxygen atom in there per unit gives you a hotter fire. It's easier to do. So even if you have like 80% crappy iron ore, if you put in 20% Sudan iron ore, it makes it better. So Sudan iron was being sent around the world to mix with iron ore in other regions where iron mining was done. And then somebody thought of this brilliant idea where, well, we can just put oxygen in there, like from an oxygen tank. Mm-hmm. We just get oxygen to stick it in there and we don't need the Sudan ore anymore. So it suddenly was not valuable because you have to dig it from really deep down. And the Sudan mine, I looked it up, is 2,341 feet below the surface.
Wow.
The deepest part. So that's where that, and that's where that neutrino lab is on the very bottom.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting place to visit because you can learn how they mined. First of all, they mined in the dark.
Yeah.
And second, the way they did it, the way they mined in the Sudan was they mined in the dark and there were these hematite layers. So hematite is very, very rich ore. And that's what they were digging for. And they could tell the hematite by touch. So they'd feel some hematite and smash it with their hammers and put it in a bucket. Okay. And they would do that until they had mined out an area that was maybe 20 feet down and several acres in extent. And the rock that was no good, they would throw down a hole to the lower level, which they'd already mined out and fill it in. And then they keep mining up in layers like that. And they bring you down there and they bring you out and explain this to you. Then they turn the lights off and you get to feel the rock and tell the hematite from the rock in the dark. If you are claustrophobic, the elevator car that goes down is you're packed in like sardines. and it goes down 2,341 feet, approximately. Because it, and then you get in a mine car. If you're afraid of machines and loud noises, you're in a mine car going clunk, 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 clunk at 15 miles an hour. So you're getting a 15 mile an hour wind. You go there in the summer because it's summer. That's why you go to a place like that in the summer in Minnesota.
Right.
It's now 48 degrees or something, which is really chilly when there's a 15 mile an hour wind and you didn't bring a jacket. And then they bring you into these mine areas and tell you how to mine. So it's an extremely excruciating and almost gruesome experience, which it's supposed to be. But it's a great experience to do. Great to bring the kids, scares the crap out of them.
I think I went down. I'm not sure if that was the mine I went, but I know that I went down a mine when I was a kid. And I kind of remember a similar experience. But I don't think that they turned the lights off when we were on our tour.
Okay.
They added that on later. I think that was 1971 when I went on that tour. It might have been the Sudan mine, or it might have been another one. Also on the Vermilion Range.
But there's I think Croft Mine is up there somewhere. Okay. Might be that. It also might be that these days, because of the evils of CRT-related thinking, we now look at something like mining and we admit the parts that were hard.
Yeah.
And in those days, in 71, maybe they were still glorifying it.
Yeah.
Was that mine? When did that mine close? When did Sudan mine close?
It would have been in the 1950s, I think. But
I don't know. I think it was later than that. But
so?
Well, I know a guy who worked in it.
Oh, really?
And he's like 90. So he could have been 50s, yeah.
I know it was open in 1878.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure when it closed.
We can check the internet on that later. Anyway, so another topic you were talking about before was the Sackett versus EPA Idaho wetlands.
Yep.
Decision. Yeah. You've been researching that.
Yeah, basically researching is kind of a generous way to put it, but I did read an article on it, and perhaps we could do this on another episode when I've had a chance to look into it more deeply. But, you know, just as a teaser, this is a huge Supreme Court case if you're interested in environmental issues and what can happen with a super conservative court, in that there's a battle between the EPA and a landowner. His last name is Sackett, so it's Sackett versus EPA, who bought land that had been declared a wetland. And then rather than trying to get permits, decided just to go to court for the right to build and develop that land. And the case that the government is fighting is a claim that just in general, environmental regulations are too strict and people can't do anything. So I'd like to look into that a little bit deeper, and then we can talk on our next podcast in some more detail, because it's before the court now, and it'll probably get ruled on next July when they start releasing their judgments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be interesting to see that, to hear about that.
It's kind of a nice bookend for the first win that the EPA has, and then maybe the first loss. But you know what I mean.
Major loss, yeah.
Yeah.
I did hear some discussion about this on one of the podcasts I listened to that has some lawyers on it, but there's a podcast called Sisters in Law. And they've got a couple of Supreme Court experts on that. They might have been talking about it there, but they'll definitely talk about it when it happens. The Sudan mine closed in 1962.
Okay.
So my friend is just really old and maybe worked there as a kid.
You want to hear another mining story?
Yeah.
People are familiar with Hibbing because not only did Bob Dylan and Roger Maris come from there, but it's got an open pit. It's a mine where rather than digging a shaft, they just started with their shovels and dug land. And it's a huge mine. And I used to think about a mile across, but that couldn't be realistic, but it's just a huge mine. But they decided that they needed to enlarge the mine. I think it was back in the 20s or 30s. And there was this town in the way, this town of Hibbing. And so in order to be able to increase the size of the mine so they continue digging, they actually moved Hibbing 1 mile. And they just kind of picked it up and plotted it almost exactly set all the buildings on rollers and logs and rollers, and then redug basements and all that kind of stuff, and just move hibbing so they could grow the mine.
That's amazing. You know, I'm looking at a map of Hibbing Mine, and it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's elongated. Right? It's about 6 or 8 kilometers long and 2 kilometers. Yeah, and 2 kilometers wide. So it's a mile across. The short way is a mile across. Long way is a few miles long.
And if you stand on the edge of it, it's like being at the edge of the Grand Canyon.
It reminds me of Bilboa. In New York, the New York City needed to upgrade its water supply. So they built these big reservoirs up in the Catskills. And Gilboa was a town. This is WPA, 1930s.
Okay.
And there was a town there. And they basically removed the town and built the reservoir. So the town is just a little tiny town nearby. It used to be a much bigger, must have been a logging town anyway. But yeah, it is interesting. If you look at a map, you see, if you look at when you Google in like their space view, satellite view, it looks like the Earth has been torn off north of Hibbing. It's like they just ripped off the Earth and made that a mine.
Yeah.
So they must.
Yeah. Kind of like a Jonathan Hogue type of thing. Do you remember that story? The Unpleasant Profession of Jonathan Hogue?
No, I never heard that.
Oh, it's I don't think it was Heinlein, but I read it in the same collection, short story collection that I read some Heinlein stories in, so I was associated. No, I think it is Heinlein. But anyway, so Jonathan Hogue in this particular story was, it turned out he was like an art critic, and his job was to do a critique of God's creation. So he came to take a look at
like four aliens or something, or like who hired him?
Well, just something advanced beyond above God, I guess.
Right,
God is just like an art student.
Right.
Yeah. And so you meet the main character who runs into Jonathan Hogue, and they survey the earth together, and he talks about some of the things that he doesn't like. And he says, well, I'm going to put you in this cab and I'm going to send you home and everything will look normal to you, but do not, whatever you do, roll down the windows until this 5-minute interval is up. So the main character's curiosity is kind of killing him. And so he decides, okay, well, I'm going to roll down the window. And he rolls down the window and looks out, and there's absolutely nothing. Not dark, not static, not it just nothing. And it's just Jonathan Hogue doing his reset, saying, nope, this project was no good. So that's kind of what it looks like here at the edge of Hibbing, huh?
Yeah, it looks like it. And I did look it up on Wikipedia. The mine, it's a very complicated structure, so it's hard to say, but it is 3 miles long and 2 miles wide and 535 feet deep. And it was one of the world's first mechanized open pit mines, and it was started in 1895.
Wow.
Yeah.
They got these earth movers, these Euclid earth movers that are just huge, where the tire is so like the sidewall of a tire is taller than a human.
Yeah.
You know, and then the tire.
Yeah. It's like a 25-foot diameter tire.
Yeah. Or something like that. It's just amazingly huge.
Yeah. Yeah. Mining is really amazing operation. And what you do when you go up there and you drive around, unless you go to the lookout, is you don't see the pits so much, you see the tailing piles.
Yeah.
As you're driving the highways up there, you'll see. And now I helped somebody bring a boat from Lake Vermilion, to over near Walker, which requires driving right across the Iron Range from east to west.
Right.
And it was a big boat, a really big boat with a big structure that goes with it on a trailer. So it was 18 feet, 20 feet off the surface of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting was we have to get gas on the way. So we pull the gas station, and there's just a person standing there, looks up at it and says, well, you're going to have to take this certain route. And he tells us the route. And it's like, there's only one way you can take a thing that big, but there's no problem. Because I was thinking, we're going to be driving with this big giant thing behind the truck. We're going to get pulled over.
Uh-huh.
And as we're driving through the Iron Range, I look, and there's this giant, giant, giant thing. That's like 10 times bigger than what we have. And it's a piece of mining equipment. And it's like driving down the street. In a little while, there's another thing pulled off the side of the road. There's these giant vehicles everywhere. And everybody who lives there just knows which bridges you can drive under with the big thing, which overpasses, right. You know, which way right. to go. And otherwise you can't go there. So we know which one's ways to go. But and what it kind of scares me, harking back to something we're talking about with Megan, which is the copper mining. I've been up to Ely in the middle of that area a couple of few times. And the last time I was up there, they had been rebuilding the roads. And there's a place between Ely and South to like where the forest ends, where there's a road that goes over a river. And it only needs to be a 2-lane highway in each, you know, one lane in each direction. Cause like, it's not, there's no cars up there, right? Nobody goes there. Hardly anybody goes there. And so there's a road that goes over this bridge, the bridge that goes over this river, and the bridge is wide enough to have three or four like giant M1 tanks side by side and big enough to hold them with a little tiny road in the middle of it. I'm thinking, okay, and I don't know if people realize that or not, but this is a bridge built for iron mining equipment to drive on.
Right.
And they say, we're just going to build a little mine up here, no big deal. But they've actually rebuilt the road to handle this big equipment quietly. And if you look at the utilities, you see, oh, guess what? There's no overhead lines over this road here. When the line's going to cross the road, it goes under the road, not over the
right.
road. And that's all for mining in a place yeah. to say they're not really going to do much mining. So it's one of those cases where like they build a big clover leaf and they never build the highways. And it just sits there in the middle of it, like Los Angeles or something, because it's there. Right. There's one in South Africa like that, in Cape Town. It's one of these big roads like that no one's ever going to use. That road will never need to be repaved or rebuilt because it's just built for handling super giant trucks that are hopefully never going to go there because they've never been to the mining up there.
Well, these are the kind of conversations that Greg and I have when we get together. We're going to be putting together another podcast pretty soon where we'll talk about electrical powered cars. And I hope that you stay tuned for episode number 32. This was 31. Thanks again for listening to Iconocast.